Today on Anatomy of a Movie, we talk about Damien Chazelle's critically acclaimed La La Land. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Popcorn Talks show, Anatomy of a Movie. We are here talking about La La Land. Big film. Yes. That everyone's so talking about and buzzing about. I'm your host, Marissa Serafini. You can follow me on Twitter at SerafiniTV. And today we have a full panel.
A full house.
I'm very excited. Everyone, introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Wanger. Good to be back with you all. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and all over the internet at Stephanie Wanger.
I'm Emily Harlan. You can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram at OMG. It's MLE.
Hey, movie fans. Dimitri Panos here. And you can support me on Twitter at DMovies1701.
Hi, I'm Becca Brown, and you all can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Becca B Talks TV.
Excellent. All right, La La Land, Damien Chazelle's follow-up to Whiplash, even though coincidentally this was in development before Whiplash really became a thing. But as usual, this is a very spoiler-filled show. You can download our rundown in the description below. And there's a lot of good information that we'll obviously cover and talk about in full detail. But as usual, let's start with quick thoughts. Stephanie, how about you?
I really enjoyed this movie. I had really high expectations going into the film. I think that around LA, it's been talked about a lot. This movie is going into award season. And for me, it totally lived up to it. It's a love story between Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling, two of my favorite actors. And in addition to that, it's kind of telling a story. It's like a love story to LA and also a little bit of the heartbreak of trying to like live your dream. And it, for me, it really worked as a film.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. Loved this film. Same thing. There was so much hype to this. So it was something that I definitely was going into it with high expectations. But anything with Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling, like sign me up. I don't even care what it is. I'm going to go see it. And I loved this film. I mean, for those of you that don't know, I know Dimitri knows this, but I live in a fantasy land. And so I love the happy ending in movies, and like everybody ends up together and everything's happy and at the end. And although this didn't necessarily play that out in full, I still really, really enjoyed this film. Same thing, just the balance of dreams, living your dream, and also kind of the reality and the sacrifices you have to make, I thought was so just relevant and, you know, something that everybody could kind of pull from. So I loved it, everything about it.
Go ahead. I always defer to the woman first.
Going into the film, like, I had seen, like, so much about it on Twitter and stuff, and that's why I, like, originally, like, was like, okay, I'm gonna check this out. So I went last Friday, and then, I don't know, it's just, like, a feel-good movie, and I'm kind of obsessed with it. I downloaded the soundtrack after watching the movie and saw it again on Wednesday. I thought it was incredible.
So you saw this twice?
Yeah.
Wow. So you really like this film?
Yes.
All right. Dimitri, how about you?
You know, I think I'm going to be the first. I was not gaga for La La Land here. Big fan of Damien Chazelle. And I think he works hard to bring the musical back. And obviously his passion for jazz and old Hollywood ooze off the screen in great prime technicolors. But his camera work dances, I thought, as wistfully as his characters, and he truly has a zest for storytelling, and for the most part, I think he succeeds, but when you're going for that vibrant, whimsical movie, he just didn't stick the end for me. You should go all the way. Mm-hmm. And he purposely decided to not do that, and I gotta be honest, that bothered me. I really got into the story, and I was like trying to say, well, what are you saying about romance and love? Like, are you saying that two people who really love each other can't continually support one another in their dreams and aspirations, and you can't do that together? So that's sort of like, I was expecting and wanted this to be a hopeful, optimistic movie, and I wanted to walk out with that feeling. And I didn't. And I thought of another movie that I saw earlier this year, which is a very underserved, underappreciated movie called Sing Street, which is not a musical per se, but it really focuses around a lot of music. And that movie hit all the notes, and it just became this wonderful, heartfelt, and it had heart. And for some reason, I just think Damien Chazelle, while he loves Hollywood, he obviously loves L.A., and he loves movies, I'm not entirely sure he loves people. You know, I mean, when you look at when you look at Whiplash, you know, mm-hmm. and Whiplash, I think is a far better movie. It's an Whiplash is an amazing movie. We broke it down here. We had the sound editor on for Whiplash, and the end is very debatable. Like, we had great discussion about the end of that movie and what that meant. But again, it's a very hard movie about people being mean to one another. And in this movie, it's like, it just ended up being just another LA story where we, you know, people get together, they break up because they got to follow their own passions. And I feel if you're in love, you can support one another in that. And I wanted that whimsical feel. So
I kind of have to agree with you, Dimitri, too. I did enjoy this film. Like, as if, you know, you follow me, Stephanie, you and I, we did the Glee after show on our sister network, AfterBuzz TV. Go check it out. but, like, I'm a big fan of musicals. And like, I always appreciate, like, those type of movies and what, you know, they resonate with people. I like the story, but, however, I felt the movie started off great for this. But I felt the second half wasn't as strong as the first half. I think tonally it kind of dragged a bit and just slowed down compared to what the first half was. They got all the spectacle out of the way, and then the second half was just kind of about the story. And these characters, I kind of questioned, like, did we like the characters, and were they good enough, likable enough to follow throughout the whole movie? And even at the end, I'm like, I'm not sure if I even... Not to sound mean or anything, like, I'm not sure if I cared about them at the end, which is really upsetting because they are the protagonists of the film. And I think the story just kind of didn't suit well for me at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, though, we talked a little bit about this after seeing the movie.
Yes, and we saw it together.
We saw it together. But I feel like in some ways... Maybe that was an intentional choice on the director's part, that the first part was this spectacle. And I think that everybody moves to L.A. thinking, like, oh, it's going to be great. I'm going to be a star tomorrow, and it's going to be this, like, whole thing. And, like, it's this love story, and then you get to the reality of it, and that's the second half of the movie, is that it's about sacrifice. And, yes, maybe you love each other, but does it always work? Maybe not. And that's a sad fact, but, like... I think that that was more the intention, or at least for me, that's what I got.
Yeah, but this isn't Rent. Like,
exactly.
This isn't Rent. Like, this starts off as I'm going to be a whimsical thing. I mean, and it's not like it gets dark towards the end. I guess the other thing that sort of bothered me is, like, the intention of the breakup, too. Like, I didn't feel... Like, this is a guy that literally drove to Nevada to tell her about an audition. If that's not love, like, and if that's not worth having in your life, that you put your own needs ahead of you, like, those things sort of bother me. So it wasn't about, like, he didn't, like, I was, like, questioning, did they break up? Like, that scene, like, he came home to surprise her, and she was legitimately, like, surprised, and I was like, aw, that's look, call me a silly romantic, but if I watch a whimsical musical, which this, number one, let's get this out of, this movie, there is no denying it's a musical within the first 3 minutes.
Oh, for sure.
Okay.
Within the first 3 seconds.
We'll
talk about the interstate scene, but I think from a marketing standpoint, this sort of kind of been hiding that it's a musical. This is a musical. Mm. Like,
well, that's exactly my question, because while I was watching this film, I think it kind of had issues of what kind of genre it was trying to find itself under. Yes, it has musical elements to it, but is it a drama? Is it comedy? There were some comedy bits in it, but, like, I think it was having issues of, like, I couldn't tell tonally what kind of movie this was.
Beautifully shot. Wonderfully shot. The prime, again, the colors where I saw it just popped off the screen.
Gorgeous.
And the way that it was filmed, whether it was like Singing in the Rain, that the costuming was classic yet contemporary. Mm-hmm. I just felt, you know, and I love that whole thing. The romantic in me was like, they could have stayed together. Like, I ended up being bummed that it was just an L.A. story about people pursuing their L.A. dreams.
Yeah. I feel like he kind of pushed her into that, though, where he, you know, that scene where she's like, okay, well, where do we stand? And he's like, when you get this role, you have to put all of you into it. So I felt like he kind of set up the relationship for, like, okay, you got to go do your thing. And if we end up together, great. If not, that's fine too. You know, it kind of felt to me like he was kind of, yeah,
I felt he was encouraging her though. Yeah. Like in a relationship, you encourage the other person. You don't want that. I mean, she had an amazing opportunity.
And he encouraged potentially, her.
And he encouraged her. And I didn't get outside of, we'll talk about it later too. He was making money. Like what happened to that? Like, he could have opened up his club a hell of a lot earlier than the 5 years later. Like, yeah. There was stuff like that.
We'll get to it.
I think it would have been interesting if they had, like, shown, like, maybe, like, 2 years after their talk, if, like, they were still trying to be together or what was, like, their current status at the moment. Because the next time we see them is 5 years later, and it's like, okay, so what happened in between that time?
Yeah, it seems like all communication was lost between those two. Other than the fact that they pursued their own dreams.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll definitely get into it. We obviously have a lot of thoughts. But let's start with the development of this, obviously. Damien Chazelle, what I found interesting was that he actually had this story before Whiplash really became a thing. And he conceptualized this while he was still in Harvard.
Yeah, wow. and he also credits that he made a $50,000 16mm we were just talking about film school movies.
Yeah.
And he made a 16mm musical called Guy and Madeline on a park bench, which was about a musician, a jazz pianist, in fact, and about their romance. And he said those were the seeds that stuck with him to do La La Land. But, you know, trying to do anything different in this town. And this is where I applaud him, you know, at least, you know, he tried, you know, I'm going to make a musical. And he told people, it's going to be a musical set in LA. Oh, yeah, and they don't get together. Okay. And that was like, everybody's like going, yeah, okay.
That's an easy sell.
I think in the research, it's interesting that he initially had it planned because he was at Harvard when he initially came up with the idea to have it in Boston.
Right.
And I feel like that would be a very different film in actuality because I think that as cliche as it is, people understand like the LA dream, if you want to call it that. And so having this movie set in that universe kind of, you know, where it's going, where in Boston, I think there's a lot more room for, I don't know, just a different story. Like this feels like very much an LA story.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah absolutely. Yeah. It's an LA story.
Like most people from LA are actually transplants.
You know? Oh, for sure. And he is, you know?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's like kind of like his own journey, like to LA to try to become, you know, the successful director, writer. And can we just point out that he's like 31 years
old?
So yeah. Thanks for making me feel like an underachiever. And, you know,
like,
gosh.
We're that age. We're like, oh, what are we doing?
Yeah, gosh. Yeah.
But we can't compare ourselves to him.
Well, right, exactly. Track,
he has
though,
a great career ahead
too.
Of him.
Well, yeah, but yes. You know, I mean, his career track from Whiplash, starting off as a short, and then being picked up to be made as a feature length film, and then getting the accolades and the various Academy Awards that it won. I mean, that puts him on the map.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it comes time, you know what? I have this La La Land, and even with Whiplash under his belt, still having a tough time getting it off the ground until, it was Lionsgate Summit who figured that they, you know, they lost out on the bidding of Whiplash and they didn't want to potentially lose out here and with the casting and everything. I just found it very interesting, you know, the genesis of this project started off back in Boston, you know, And who says there can't be romantic movies that are set in Boston? Did nobody ever see The Town? Come on, that was a very romantic movie. So
Good Will Hunting.
Good Will Hunting.
Even though that's a sad movie. But
yeah. I have to say, going into the movie, I didn't watch Whiplash before. So I actually became like a Damien fan after the movie ended. And I went home and I'm like, I'm going to watch Whiplash and rented it on iTunes and incredible too.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, so awesome. he definitely has the ability to, you know, create such an amazing project. And what I found interesting with this film is that it had a few stalls. I mean, it's stalled at Focus Features.
Sure. Oh, Jesus.
And then, you know, they eventually got picked up from, you know, Lionsgate that actually helped give them the financial backing to fully execute what they were wanting to film in this movie.
But what happened at Focus, too, though, there was a regime change. Like, it was going to go forward at Focus, and then the person, this James Shamus, they left the company. There was a change, and so, hence, what's the saying in this town? You throw the baby out with the bathwater, or you throw the bathwater out with the wash. Like, they just throw everything out. Regardless of whether it's a good product or not, it's like, nah, it's associated with them.
Yeah.
We don't want it. Yeah. And it's a musical.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's tough. It's as tough. The only other movie that right now that I can compare this to that probably had a bigger uphill battle was The Artist. That's a black and white silent movie.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. How do you, so this is sort of kind of one best picture. Yep. This is what I sort of kind of compare. This is what I can compare La La Land to in trying to get it pitched.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, I found it interesting in the development of this that there was a completely different cast. It wasn't always Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone. It's Miles Teller, who, of course, was in Whiplash, and Emma Watson. And I feel like it obviously would have been a younger couple, like maybe a I don't know exactly how old they would have been, maybe 25, 26? Like
mid-20s compared to late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah, and so I feel like it changes the movie. That alone changes the movie, but also that casting would feel very different in this movie than Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone.
Yeah, I completely agree. I can't really... at first, when I heard that it was going to be Miles Teller, I'm like, what? No way. But now I can kind of see how that would have happened, but I don't think it would have been the same feel, like you said, at all. It would have been a completely different feel to the film. So I'm glad the cast... Sorry, Miles, but I'm glad the casting change happened.
Yeah, I'm glad it happened because it kind of happened for the better, even though they went off to their own different projects. But Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling have already worked together twice. Yeah. Chemistry has already been established on screen. So the fact that they're together again for the third time, there's no problem in denying their chemistry.
Right.
It's already
there.
And it was a smart I get it, although I'm still very interested in the Miles Teller, Emma Watson, because Miles Teller is a great actor, and obviously when you see him in Whiplash, Damien Chazelle knows he's going to put his all into making this work, and Emma Watson has proven to be a really strong actress as well. But as things started to fall apart, like, again, when things stall so much, that's when Chazelle started working on Whiplash more. Like, okay, this ain't going anywhere, but I'm gonna keep it, I gotta work on Whiplash. And in a sense, when you, the crazy stories about how development works, in this particular case, it worked out because if he didn't do Whiplash, I'm not entirely convinced that he would have been able to do La La Land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think La La Land was offered to him while he was filming Whiplash, was my understanding of it. So,
well, he was in the running for it, and then Teller was actually upset that he didn't get it, that they were going creatively a different route.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was because Whiplash won at Sundance, marked the arrival of Chazelle to the wider world, and La La Land became a real conversation again after winning Sundance. And then, Lionsgate put in a bid on Whiplash, and they lost out, as I said. And then, for Stardust Summit, the gentleman, Paul Feig, presided over and produced the Step Up Dance franchise, and they spoke about Emma Watson, Miles Teller. I think it's Eric Feig, I'm sorry, not Paul, the director. But Summit was doing these Perks of Being a Wallflower. They did these successful...
Also starring Emma Watson.
Everything fell into place for Chazelle to get this movie made and to make it the way he wanted to make it too, because Lionsgate gave him that birth. They didn't want him to change things.
Going back to what you were saying with Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling, they were also a known commodity at this point. Like, the Crazy Stupid Love is like one of those things where people go and like watch those scenes with them and are super, like, I have a friend who's super excited just by like that portion of the film. So, I think that that's something that also helps when you have a movie like this, having those known commodities come in.
Yeah. I watched an interview where they were like, where someone mentioned like they're like the perfect looking Hollywood couple, and I'm like, yeah, I know her.
Yeah, they kind of have that. They can have that old timey look too. Yeah. That I feel like the film kind of plays off of. You know, right. They kind of can look like they're from the 50s or 60s or whatever. Yeah. You know, they kind of have that feel, that look to them. So that I think that helped too.
Yeah, and for me, it just. I mean, Emma Stone in this movie, if she doesn't get, to me, she was the one. She was the one that really leapt off the screen. Mm-hmm. Like whenever she was on. It was just hard not to take your eyes off of her.
Yeah.
And, you know, she would be a shoo-in to get an Academy Award nomination for yeah. actress. And, you know, trying to figure out who she might be up against, I think she has a really good shot. She was so, like, magnetic. And yeah. even with her dancing, her singing, her acting, it was just hard. Like, every time she came on, it was even hard. Like, Ryan Gosling's a great actor, but you focused on her. Mm-hmm. She was just, to me, I thought she was amazing.
Especially yeah. the audition scene.
Yeah.
Which one?
Yeah.
The end audition scene was incredible.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we'll definitely get to that as well. But let's talk about the writing, you know, obviously written by Damien Chazelle, but he also was with his writing partner, Justin Hurwitz, who was also his friend from Harvard, who also did the music for yes. this movie. So you can definitely tell they have a good working relationship about, you know, the story. And what I found interesting is while they were shooting and stuff, they would change the script to help with the actors and their personal, you know, talents to help, you know, cater to that. So the script did change over the test of while they were filming, mm-hmm. instead of being, like, completely set from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So it showed the, you know, the creative liberties that, and, like, he allowed them to be collaborative. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, which I think is not always the case on these kinds of films. I think, especially if you have a film for so long, it's sometimes, like, you want so much control over it and to have something that's so collaborative. And I know I've saw several interviews with Ryan Gosling talking about kind of how he learned to play piano and, like, all of the stuff that he kind of brought to the table. And I think it's exciting. Like, that was one of the things that I felt like people seemed... Sometimes you can tell when a movie set is not great, and this felt like a movie set that people actually enjoyed yeah. being on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think one of the things that impressed me most was that Ryan Gosling learning how to play piano thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, geez, he was good.
Yeah, he was really good. Yeah.
Yeah, and they didn't have to, like, Miles Teller knew how to play drums.
Yeah.
But he was never that, like, he was never that good. And I think piano is a little, there might be a little more finesse on a piano, but if you watch, like, they do some great camera trickery and editing in yes. Whiplash. They film Miles Teller too from behind a lot. Where in this, there was no digital,
yeah.
you know, shenanigans going on. So if the camera went from his hands on the piano, and then it would wipe up into his face, and, like, you saw that he was, you know, playing the keys and acting as if he was really playing the piano. I there wasn't a time that I doubted it, and there wasn't a time that I thought that there was digital trickery going on either.
I was waiting for that kind of break because I didn't think that it would actually be him, you know? And then, yeah, when it kind of panned up, I'm like, oh, my God, that's really him playing. And I saw something that he spent 2 hours a day, 6 days a week in piano lessons learning to play the piano just for this film. And by the end of it, they did not have to use a hand double or any CGI. So I thought, like, absolutely what dedication.
Yeah, dedication.
Yeah. That's super incredible, yeah.
He's gorgeous and he can play piano.
I know,
piano.
Just add another thing on the list for Ryan Gosling. Jeez.
Play piano at my future wedding?
No? Yeah, there you go.
Or at our wedding. But yes, yeah, so, I mean, we're talking about Ryan Gosling. Let's talk about him and what he brought to this character of Sebastian, also playing, you know, being a jazz musician in this film, playing the piano. But what did you think of his performance from where his character started and how his character ended?
I liked the snobby side of him, kind of. At the more of the beginning, I don't know. It made me, like, more excited to watch and, like, see where the film was gonna go, to see, like, the trailer and then, like, the beginning of the movie where he's all snobby. and like close-minded, I guess, kind of.
Yeah, I really liked his performance in here. I liked kind of how his character, I felt like he never really, or his character, I guess, never really, I don't want to say changed a whole lot, but he still had that kind of like stubbornness that he was going to make his dreams come true regardless of the fact, you know, from the very beginning, he's like, this is what I'm going to do. And there was that little dip in the middle where he did kind of sacrifice his dreams for something that he didn't necessarily believe in, but at the end ended up, you know, following through and making everything happen. So I felt like it kind of, for me, stayed pretty much the same from start to finish. You know, as far as his character and just kind of that stubbornness. And he in one of his interviews said that he believed his character believed that if you have enough heart and talent that things will fall into place, you know, just kind of how they're supposed to be. So,
yeah, I mean, ever since Drive, Ryan Gosling to me has always had something similar to the Steve McQueen kind of cool to him. And it sort of kind of stuck with him and all his future roles, whether it be Crazy Stupid Love, whether it be The Nice Guys, which I think he was amazing in. And in this movie, he still has that coolness to him that he can carry off and be in that kind of 40s, 50s type of musical. Because you sort of kind of need that. I mean, Fred Astaire... Like there was not only did he have the body language of to dance, but he could be sort of cool and fun, and he emulated that. Ryan Gosling did. You know, his character. Look, again, it just goes back to me to the Damien Chazelle just has this passion for jazz, and there are conversations that take place in this movie and in Whiplash about, you know, if nobody's gonna listen to jazz, like, you gotta do this. And, you know, I am a fan of jazz as well, and I get it to an extent, you know, what he was talking about. And, you know, I love the whole tapas and what was it? Tapas and samba. Yeah, yeah. Tapas and samba. What is that? You do one thing really good and just stay with it. Is it tapas or samba? But I get the whole thing that he's talking about regarding jazz, and when people hear about it, they think of like Kenny G or something.
Smooth jazz.
And I love the fact that he took Emma Stone to a really great jazz club, and they got to, she was exposed to it to a point where she actually appreciated it. She goes, okay, I see what you're talking about. But I think that's all because of Damien Chazelle's passion for that, and I think that oozes off the screen. So if anybody picks up the Whiplash soundtrack because they're like going, oh, wow, this is really great stuff. And people can walk away with a finer appreciation. I'm all for it because I think it's fantastic. But that's the way I felt about his character, his stubbornness, so to speak. I just wish that when he took that gig to make money, he was happy to make money, right? And he was making good money because apparently they were a hit. Touring, and he got a cut of the touring profits. He got a cut of merchandise plus $1,000 a week. I was like, A, why didn't you move out of that apartment? B, why weren't you buying that club already? Like, this was all money that you could do to put it, like, you could still have your dream and do that. I don't know. I was just like, you're making good money now. Like,
I think it was more so he was just paying his dues. And maybe it just took him 5 years to finally pursue his dream.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, going off of what you said, that, like, Damien actually was, like maybe kind of wrote or, like, had the character written, like, to be like him.
Mm-hmm.
Had the character of Sebastian written to be like him because he's pushing jazz out to the audience of the film. So
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he does, and he did that in Whiplash, you know, and you get it. And I love when a director is able to do that and tell a story and not have you feel like you're beaten over the head with it.
Right.
But you can tell his passion, but you can tell his passion for movies as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this kid, he grew up loving movies and respecting the craft of making movies. I can't take that away, whether I thought about the ending. This is a beautiful movie, and his respect for the old school... This movie, I don't know how it was in your theater, so I'm going to throw this out there. I saw it at the Landmark Theater. So when the movie opens, the curtains were drawn towards the middle, so all I saw like filmed in CinemaScope, and then the curtains pulled back, and you saw that beautiful old style original CinemaScope logo, and it said filmed in CinemaScope, and it was so colorful and gorgeous, and just the use of curtains, because curtains were always used at that to crop, depending on how a movie was filmed, they would crop the screen. That's what they were basically for. And I just saw it pull back, and I was like, that's such a nice touch. The only thing that was missing was filmed in Technicolor, because all those movies were filmed in that beautiful Technicolor. But right from then, you knew that, okay, he has a passion for this.
What I loved about that was that it felt, like a movie from another era, but then you had these moments, kind of going back to the writing, where it was very current day. Like, everybody has a Prius. Like, you know, like, and it, like, they're...
I used to have a Prius.
Yeah, like, ordering... like, at a coffee shop, it's like a mocha latte, blah, blah, blah. Like, and it felt, like, very current, but also in that, like, big movie scope of older movies.
I love their self-awareness, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, because even at the very beginning, right after the Interstate musical, and then we saw this, like, winter, and they just sang a song about being in the sunny day.
Yeah.
It was, like, the same.
This is winter in LA. It's still sunny. But, like, those little moments that you reminds, like, I think it's the LA humor that only us that we would understand in Los Angeles, but if you're on the East Coast, you probably, it would go over your head.
Yeah.
I mean, you get it. If it's a, I think if you're in Boston watching La La Land and it says winter, you're like laughing. It's like, yeah, come over here and I'll show you winter. But, it, to your point too, like I was talking to someone last night and I said, you know, we're in a year of throwbacks. It's like everybody's clamoring so hard to throw, not even sequels, but just to be nostalgic. Just to look at Allied is a throwback movie. It's everything is looking towards the past of film history and how movies were shot, and this movie is no exception. I did like that there was no overuse of, say, the cell phone. Like, it never current technology never, like, overshadowed anything. Like, it never became, it was there, but it was there as, like, a normal use, you know. So yes, it was modern day, but yet you still had people dancing in the streets, and you had the great scene at that party, jumping in the pool. It was the way in which that was filmed that was all nostalgic, but it's today. It felt classic.
Yeah,
we'll get a little bit more into the cinematography too, but you know, let's talk about Emma.
Yeah,
we talked about Ryan, but Emma Stone and her performance, she blew me away in this.
Yeah,
I was like, she can do drama, she can do comedy, and then now she can do musicals. So it's like, this girl has it all.
Yeah,
honestly. And I think we mentioned it earlier, but her audition scene, I never knew like how much and how real she could get, and her performance and what she, you know, really just performed, it was so heartfelt and emotional. And
which audition scene?
The audition at the end when she was, that was
the one
changed
song?
Her career.
Right here,
yeah.
The fourth.
That changed her career.
Because I point to the one where she was on her phone.
Oh, the emotional.
Like movie, having that.
Oh, that one too.
And it gets interrupted.
It gets interrupted.
Yeah.
She was fantastic in this movie. I can't see anybody else at this point. Like, I don't know what her competition will be, but she literally commanded the screen, and she did it effortlessly. Like, it was fun. There was another scene where the camera would go to her dancing, and then it'd go back to
Ryan Gosling.
In the jazz bar.
And I'm like, go back to her. Like, go back to her. She seemed to have so much fun, and she seemed so comfortable in that world. She was great.
I was just gonna say that I think she's brilliant in everything she does. I was trying to think of, like, her back, you know, the past movies, and I'm like, is there something she did that I did not necessarily enjoy? And I can't think of anything for me personally. I love all of her films, and especially in this one, like you said, I feel like she just jumped off the screen with everything she did, and just her range of emotion as an actress, you know, that end scene, or, you know, I guess the end audition, when she's like just so vulnerable and raw. And then she had these moments of joy and brilliance and, I don't know, just everything. Her whole range as an actress in this film, I thought, was incredible.
I agree with you, yeah. I think that it's, you know, it proves again and again that she's just this amazing leading lady. Like, kind of, again, a throwback. Like, I don't think there's a lot of them that are still around that you're like, I will watch her in anything. I think of, like, Easy A is, like, I think, like, was one of the first, like, big movies that she led.
Super bad, not so. I mean, she didn't lead it.
But, like, I remember thinking in Easy A, like, this girl's a movie star. And over the course of, you know, 5 or 6 years now, we've seen her prove it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think she, like, tries too hard in movies either. Like, it just seems so, like, it seems so real.
It seems natural. Acting.
Yeah.
I think she tries hard. I just... There are some people who it's very natural with, and she has a natural ability. And I'm going to say the same about, like, Gosling has a natural ability. I just don't think, again, and I don't want to take away from him, when she was on screen, I was like, I had to watch whether, and it could, she could have just been blinking her eyes, and I was just like, you know, she could read a phone book, and I would have been... Like, that could have been her audition, and I would have thought, bravo. Like, amazing.
Yeah, well, the thing that I liked about this character was that she was probably the most relatable.
Yeah.
And especially us here being in LA, like, we understand the person who's going through the struggle of this industry.
Yeah.
The one who tries over and over again. The thought of rejection and how real that is, and yet she gets to that point in life where she gives up and, like, moves back with her family. Like, everyone... Who has, like, been an actor goes through those ups and downs and ebbs and flows of, will I get this role, will I not, you know, and just the constant rejection that people are just so tired of, but they keep, you know, moving forward every single day.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I really like that, because that was relatable.
Yeah. I thought about that driving here today, actually, you know, just how real that was and how many times I've been in that situation, you know, where you're just like, you have this dream and you want it to happen so bad because you're so passionate about it, but you keep getting rejection after rejection to the point where you finally give up, but then something happens and you go back at it. And I totally agree. It felt so relatable and so real, especially to us here, trying to, you know, live this dream.
Yeah, and I think...
I get you, girl. I feel you.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, I think it was outside of her house, her childhood home, and she's talking to Ryan, and they're saying, and she's talking about that, like, the dream is just, like, too heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, we've definitely all had those moments where you're like, do you go on and how do you, like, make that left or right turn to continue and like, find it within yourself? And I felt like that was one of the strongest moments in the film.
That was one of my favorite scenes in the film. And
I was
incredible. And also, and I'm interested because we keep saying, like, we get it. I'm interested to, like, go see it with my family in Dallas over the holidays. And, like, the theater's reaction there because, this is all, like, an L.A. thing.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, like, LA, we know. Stephanie, you and I, we saw it together. And, like, I would like to see it with other people who aren't in the industry, who doesn't have that mentality of how it works.
Personally, I think that's going to be its biggest uphill climb. It's biggest uphill battle. A, it's a musical. I already know people. Oh, it's a musical? Check me out.
No,
I'm done. See you later. It's just the bottom line. I mean, people just don't like musicals. I mean, they don't. I'm just stating a fact. I mean, I already know a couple of people have already said, La La Land's a musical? I didn't know that. Oh, I wanted to see it. It's a musical?
Well, no? Like, even on the flip side, like, I would talk to people, you know, in the Midwest, and they're like, what's La La Land? Like, they don't know what this movie is.
Let's be fair, though. I mean,
we know about it.
Well, we know about it because we're hypersensitive to award season. We're hypersensitive to the news.
Yeah.
I mean, the movie, thus far, it's only in 200 theaters. I mean, it opened up, on December 9th, and it only opened up in New York and L.A. I mean, it's just building a groundswell. When you're coming out at Christmas time up against movies like a Rogue One, that's what the movie going audience is being attuned to. But once it starts, like, you know, the Golden Globes and things like that, it's going to widen out. It'll eventually, you know, it may not be playing in Dallas just yet, but it'll be playing in bigger cities like Chicago to start, like in San Francisco. It'll start to, once like a groundswell happens, it'll build up. I mean, but again, right now we're just talking 200 locations. It's not a lot yet.
I also think that the awards that this movie will more than likely get, it's gotten Golden Globe nominations, all of that. It will more than likely get Oscar nominations. Will help get that attention because people watch those shows and then they go and find those films. And I think that you'll see throughout award season this movie get more and more attention just based off of winning.
And because of those nominations, they'll actually widen the release to the people who can actually see this.
Absolutely. Again, though, I'm like, you know, comparing it to the artist. You know, now I was doing some research before we started and I was actually pleasantly surprised. The Artist pulled in, all in, $44 million, and that was Best Picture. I think the only reason why it pulls in $44 million is because of its award nominations and award wins, like, throughout the entire season. I mean, that, for a studio, it's free publicity. Like, the publicity team works to try to push and get the nominations. But once that gets out there, then that marketing machine has a wave and they have things to work with and they know, okay, well, we've got Best Picture, we put it in the ads, we can beef up TV, and it's a groundswell, it's a wave that continues and you hope to ride it. And then if you win that coveted Best Picture, you know, whether it's even Golden Globes, like, that'll start it. But if you win Best Picture, it helps, only unless, like, that, and I don't see it happening with La La Land. The only thing that would hurt its gross is as if they decided to release it on Blu-ray, like, around the Academy Awards. Mm-hmm. Then people aren't going to go see it at the theater, and they'll lose that, you know.
People just watch it at home.
Yeah, they'll lose that box office. But I think they've released it at such a time where it's garnering a ton of attention. So,
interesting. Let's get into the production and cinematography. We talked a little bit about it, but the way it was filmed, you know, shot 35mm, 93 locations, 48 exterior locations, and 1,600 extras. I mean, this film, I mean, like, you can definitely tell their musical numbers were over the top grand, and how they filmed it was, oh my goodness, amazing. Dimitri, you had a few more things on the CinemaScope.
Yeah, I mean, again, it took 40 days to shoot, which for this kind of a movie, I'm actually surprised it was only 40.
Yeah.
You know?
You wouldn't think it. Like, with all the things that they accomplished, they managed to get that in 40 days.
Yeah, and you know, considering the dance scenes, and considering they actually would spend, for example, we'll talk about the freeway scene, but another major scene was that dance scene with a girls' night out, and they're going to that party.
Yeah.
And then Ryan and Emma meet and walk out of the party. A lot of this movie was done, let's call it real time, being that they shot it in L.A., purposely as the sun was coming down. They wanted to shoot it at what is called the magic hour, which is at like 7:30 at night, to get that glimmer. And they didn't want to lose that. And being that you're shooting on, they actually shot on film. If they shot digitally, they could have shot it anytime and made it look to whatever. Mm-hmm. They shot it on film. So they had to rehearse. They would rehearse like an entire day. And that party scene, actually, they did over 20 takes, like, just to make sure to edit together and make sure they had the lighting of the sky and of the LA background just right. That to me, considering that you're using film, it's like, well, that's an awful lot of film. Like, that's got to bring the budget up. But the budget was actually fairly modest, but it was that kind of detail. It wasn't like we changed the lighting situations. We didn't fix it in post, so to speak. We're actually shooting. Mm-hmm. Like, what you're seeing on film is when we actually shot this movie. And I found that to be like, who does that anymore? I found that to be amazing. And the scene that's behind us is one of the scenes that I'm talking about.
Yeah, the Prius scene where we saw all the those Priuses lined up. Yeah.
I have to say that, like, I just enjoyed, in terms of, we talk about 40 locations. If you know LA, it's kind of a Where's Waldo in LA. Yeah. Like, you're like, oh, that's Silver Lake, that's this, like, Griffith Park. Like, you can point out all of these things. And, like, there's a scene when she's doing the Prius and she, like, walks up the hill. And I'm like, oh, she's actually walking up to the Griffith Observatory. You don't really realize it when you're, like, watching if you don't know that area. But that, I'm sure, helped in the 40 days because they were able to get that and then, like, be in similar locations. Yeah. They were very strategic in the way they filmed this, for sure.
Yeah. I found a website where, like, they had all the, like, filming locations, and I'm like, wow, I wonder, like, how much tourist activity is going to go up in these locations that they filmed in after people see this movie.
Yeah.
First thing I thought of.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and we have to talk about the opening number.
Yes, let's do that. The whole, that was amazing. I mean, that's how you start a movie.
Yes.
Honestly. But yeah, Dimitri, you were...
Yeah, I mean, you know, it took them 3 weekends in L.A. at that off-ramp. It was in the middle of
the 105 freeway to the 110.
Which is not far from where I live, and I know exactly that freeway because it's... Number one, I'm going to be honest with you, it's a really high off-ramp. And every time I've taken it, getting from the 105 to the 110, I get scared that as soon as I'm on the top of it, an earthquake's going to happen and I'm done. Because it is probably the highest on-ramp that I've, like, ever gone on. So as soon as I started the movie, I'm like going, I know exactly where that is. And of course you would film there because you can see L.A. Yeah. It's there so high up. Mm-hmm. And just the amount of time that they took to film that scene, and that it's once again, you know, this is again becoming, I'm wondering when it's ever going to become cliche, but ever since like Gravity and Alfonso Cuarón, and then we had Revenant, or we had Birdman, and then the Revenant, you know, I mean, this sort of long one-take shots, but this one sets up the movie. I mean, you're right in it. If by then if you're not into musicals, you're probably walking out. Like, there is no doubt that this is going to be a musical, and the way that it was filmed and being that it was 100 degrees, you know. But my LA cynicism comes out and goes, yeah, if some kid skateboarded on the top of my car, I'd be pretty pissed. And somebody else would have probably shot him. Like, that's the thing. Like, it was so in love with L.A. that they put aside, like, the bad things that would happen if somebody actually got on top of your car, if you were in traffic and started dancing. But it's a beautiful scene. One of my favorites.
So I can't dance on top of your car?
No.
No?
Okay. No.
Well, what's also interesting is that...
I'll open the sunroof because, and you'll fall right in.
Because it's so high up, that ramp, that, like, there were some parts of the ramp that weren't blacked off, and they had to change a lot of the crane shots and stuff because Mandy Moore, the choreographer, was worried that people were actually going to fall off the cars during the number. Which, I mean, that's not really a laughing matter because...
No.
When you're dancing on top of cars on such a high platform, the safety does become, involved in that. And I find it fascinating. But what they pulled off with all those dancers in such a short amount of time.
Yeah. And Mandy Moore is, I believe, the lead choreographer on Dancing with the Stars as well. And
she's also worked on So You Think You Can Dance.
Yeah. And just incredible work time and time again from her. Like, you can see how creative she is. Because some of the dance numbers... they're in awkward spots or you're dancing around the Griffith Observatory, and to get that done and have it look beautiful, I think is really challenging.
And one thing I really appreciated that she said was that she tried really hard to make the dances still feel real and normal, to where obviously, you know, when you're watching a movie and people just break out into dance, that doesn't happen, but they still weren't these like crazy over-the-top moves to where it kind of takes the audience out. It still kind of felt like relatable and like real people, you know. It didn't really feel like you were watching some, you know, crazy performance. It still kind of felt like you were in the moment. So I appreciated that she said that.
Yeah, it wasn't like, how does everyone know the choreography of this? It goes like
exactly
1,000 miles an hour.
And I mean, she's an amazing choreographer, Mandy Moore. I worked with her for 4 hours one day. It was random day. She's super nice. And she's also been nominated for Emmys for her. So, like, she's very critically acclaimed in her own right, and she's super talented
and
to take
being
on this.
Able to shut down that that on-ramp that, you know, for the amount of time that they needed. And again, they, you know, you didn't have a ton of time because you are shutting down a major, I mean, that is a major on and off ramp. And, you know, to film, to get what they needed and to shoot that, I think, under a very time constraint, because we are in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
We think we already hate traffic as it is. Mm-hmm. And I don't care. Yeah, like, if I'm stuck in traffic and it's because of a movie, I'm going to hate that movie before it comes out.
Yeah.
Like, but, you know, it was amazing what they were able to pull off. And again, it just goes.
It was. Definitely.
Yeah, it was worth it. And again, that was. I had my other favorite scene for me was that scene in the Griffith Observatory scene. Mm-hmm. Like, were my favorites. I thought they were just beautifully shot.
Mm-hmm. To bring back, like, also another LA thing is that there's a train that is actually shut down across from Grand Central Market in downtown LA. And it's been shut, I think, for many years now, and they actually used the train in it and restarted it for a day, so that they like really made it like a lot of cool things that are like LA history coming back to life, and I just have to point that out. It's really cool.
Going back to the opening number, I watched it at the Dome, and I was captivated from like the moment that like that scene opened. And going back to Dimitri's comment about the color, like, stood out, like...
Just prime, like, beautiful reds, blues, yellows, greens, whatever they were dancing in.
Yeah.
And it was men and women alike, set them apart. Like, it was just, it was so vibrant. Like, it just beautifully done. And again, when you're filming with the CinemaScope and you have a great cinematographer filming on film... It literally, for me, like I said earlier, it popped off the screen. And I started at the Landmark.
Yeah.
So I didn't see it like, you know, it wasn't an IMAX or anything. But regardless, it just was beautiful to watch.
Yeah.
It's probably more so because of the movie. But I'm like, I'm never going to be able to see a movie in any, like, anywhere other than this place again.
Yeah.
You know, there were some scenes in this movie that reminded me of Singing in the Rain.
Oh, which, definitely.
Like, I love
but, but that that's a film. Clear influence that Damien Chazelle has.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Definitely. But, you know, there are some scenes in Singing in the Rain that were, like, super vibrant in color, like, on purpose.
Yeah.
And I definitely got that from this, in the vibrancy of the color scheme of the whole thing.
That's one of the things you made a point earlier just about how the film kind of plays with time. And I liked that about it, how it had, you know, you got the references of Singing in the Rain. You got that they're playing Rebel Without a Cause, you know, even that. Even some of the cars, I know they had the Prius, but even like the car that Ryan Gosling's character drove was kind of like this older car, you know, so they had all these moments, but still very up to date with like the Prius and the cell phone. There was one moment when they were, I think Ryan and Emma's characters were having a moment and like the cell phone, the ring went off or something, you know, so I liked how they played with that. And speaking of, you know, cinematography and wardrobe and everything, one of the costume designer said she wanted even their costumes to feel like if you bought a dress now, could you wear it 50 years ago? You know, so even every little point in the movie, you know, had a lot to do with very contemporary and modern, but also very timeless, you know. And I think she had a quote saying something like she wanted it to feel timeless with a contemporary sensibility. So I loved that about the film, all of those little mentions of the past.
I do like that. All right. I mean, we talked about Damien a little bit more, but, you know, his direction on this film, I think it was a simple story, a simple, relatable story that we all enjoyed. I think I said at the beginning that I think my issue with the story is that it totally changed throughout the movie, and it kind of got maybe a little too real that I didn't really enjoy it.
Right.
Because, I mean, it was too realistic. I'm like, I didn't feel happy at the end, where I should.
That's what I wanted. That's what I was hoping. But, again, I say it, he's a really good storyteller. I like the fact that he's 31, 32 years old. He has an appreciation for old movies, and I enjoy how he uses that in his craft, because you can see it in Whiplash. Like, Whiplash, how do you make drumming, how do you make jazz interesting?
Yeah.
Like, he states it many times, people hate jazz. So how do you go about making a movie that's really intrinsically about jazz drumming and being part of a jazz core in school? How do you make that fascinating? How do you try to make it fascinating in what is a musical that you get people interested in wanting to maybe listen to it? And I think that's where he excels. He makes things look fascinating. He gives us a different perspective of things, but yet it's all throwback. He makes it look, when you talk about Singing in the Rain, is, I can't think of another musical that's as good. I mean, Singing in the Rain is a musical about the industry, and it's the best musical about the industry. That is out there. When you tell people, well, Singing in the Rain is about trying to make a movie, people get lost. They forget that it's a movie about the business, about the Hollywood mm-hmm. business. But that's exactly what it is. And it has its whimsical and dreamlike feel, and the dancing and the chemistry. And that's what you need in a musical with your leads. He tries to pull that off here to a modicum of success for me. But there's still this wonderful dreamlike quality in La La Land that you can't take away. Like, and if they go into Sing and Dance, you know, like this scene right here, it was a great scene.
Oh, yeah.
You know? When they tap, she puts on her shoes and they're doing this tap thing. It's a beautiful scene. Mm-hmm. And it's magical and it's dreamlike. Mm-hmm. You know?
You know what's funny is I thought that the ending would bother me more than it did. Because I am 100% love a romantic comedy, like, want the happy ending, want everybody, as you mentioned earlier, the fairy tale. I'm 100% on board.
Oh, yeah.
And for some reason in this movie, I was okay with them not being together. Like, I love their relationship and their chemistry, but I somehow understood why sometimes that type of thing, if your first love is your dream and anything else comes after that, that's not always going to work. And for me, that somehow was okay in this.
Yeah, I agree. I, you know, was leaving the theater and I heard some woman talking about the end and she's like, I hate this film now. I can't, you know, she was all upset about it. And I thought, you know, I'm absolutely every single film, I like to see the characters end up together. And I think one thing that maybe softened the blow a little bit is that the direction and I guess maybe the storytelling, it didn't really hit us very hard. It wasn't like there was this big tragic ending to it and they see each other and they're all angry. And so I think just even the flashback where she's like picturing what their life could have been like. And at the very end, you know, when they kind of smile at each other and like give each other a nod, like, you're okay, I'm okay. You know, I think it kind of softened the blow a little bit. It didn't feel like it was like this tragic ending. It kind of felt more like, okay, you know, they're okay with where they're at in life kind of thing. So
My displeasure with the ending is because you did set up this whimsical fairy tale world. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't, call me whatever you want to. I am a romantic at heart, and I do believe that if you truly love one another, you're going to support each other's dreams and you're going to encourage. And I saw that in this movie. And then for some reason, like, even when they had that dinner, I didn't catch that as a breakup. Like, it's definitely not a breakup when a guy drives all the way to Nevada to tell you about... You know, I'm like thinking you're still together. And then when they did the whole, you know, but then when you see her with another guy, was that Tom Everett Scott?
Yes, it
was. Okay, that was Tom Everett Scott. I'm like, I haven't seen that guy in forever. Is it good for him?
He's been good.
And then, you know, the baby. And then I was like, well, what was the point of, like, having that whole fantasy of, like, what could have been? Because at that point, I'm like, she ain't leaving him and her kid to go back to this, what they already had a really good relationship. And I was just like, obviously, you said at the beginning, they obviously fell out of touch because she didn't even know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a coincidence of coincidences that she just happens to be by, you know, that jazz club. I'm surprised that she even decided to stay at that point. But I don't know. I like that whole montage was like, what was the point of that other than chewing up 10 minutes time? Because they ain't getting back together. Like, not she seems very settled in her life.
I kept thinking that it was like a love story of that moment, like their mid-20s, like they were there for each other when maybe they needed each other. And now as they like establish this career, both of them have separate careers, that like maybe they don't need each other. Maybe it wasn't like, if you want to call like a one true love, maybe it wasn't that, but it was something that was like in that moment they needed.
And I think sometimes like in life that there are certain people that come into your life for like certain moments and then they leave.
At the right...
Well, they come into your life for the right things and then like they go off on their merry way again. And I think it was kind of along those lines. Like they helped each other when they were together and then they eventually parted ways.
Yeah.
I think the thing that made it like most... the ending most bittersweet for me was like seeing both their dreams like had been true. And like... especially the sub sign, because it was like her artwork. And that whole like music montage thing that we had heard the music like all throughout the movie, and it was like just the music without the lyrics. I liked that part during the like alternate ending montage. I kind of left more upset, not because the characters weren't a couple, but because the actors aren't a couple in real life.
My biggest revelation was that Emma Stone's no longer with Andrew Garfield.
Who actually, coincidentally,
gave her the script.
Gave her the script to this film.
Yeah. And also, when you mentioned earlier that you could watch her read, like, a telephone book, that's actually in an interview Andrew Garfield, when they were still together, mind you, talked about.
Break up?
Like, about maybe a year ago?
Oh, Jesus.
Well, they're going to see each other at the Oscars.
Yeah.
Bridge was great, you guys.
Yes, it was. But it's interesting because, like, he obviously, like, sees her in that way or saw her in that way. And so, to hand her this script to, like, they'll both be at the Oscars. Awesome.
Yeah. Well, I love to, like, her audition was basically, I believe she was in Cabaret in New York. Yeah. And they went to go see her, and that particular night she had a cold. Too. So she's like, oh, this is the night you put it. Like, I really suck. I can barely talk. But she got the role basically because of then seeing her in Cabaret in New York, which is great. And it's one of those things. But, you know, it's interesting. You know, we talked about it earlier. You know, Miles Teller, Emma Watson, very good actors. It'd be curious. I mean,
but would they fit together?
I don't see why they... Well, I don't see why they wouldn't. I mean, in all honesty, I don't see why they wouldn't.
Well, and sometimes Emma was going on better written down, but like in actual execution, the whole different story.
I'm not saying I'm unhappy with who.
Oh, right.
Who it went to? It just... I think it would have been an interesting... I think it's an interesting choice as to who they have, because Emma Watson's on her way. Well, she's got a musical coming out early next year called Beauty and the Beast. So it's not like she can't handle doing a musical. And Miles Teller, I think, he's a dedicated actor. He learned how to drum and do that. Oh, yeah. And somebody here is West Side Story.
I love West Side Story. Yeah. Also, very vibrant,
colorful. But it's about gangs.
That's a good observation.
Yeah, but it's about gangs.
But there's a love story.
Yeah.
There's a love story. But the vibrancy.
But it's Romeo and Juliet, too. I mean, you know. So we know
they don't end up together.
Yeah, we know that's not a happy
one. Yeah, I was waiting that end scene when she walks in and she's kissing this other guy. I honestly was like, she's filming a movie. I'm waiting. I was waiting for a director to yell cut, you know, and it's like, oh, okay, that was just a movie. Now she's going to go to the club and
that would have been
see.
Cute.
I know. Like, the fantasy land in me was like, this is what's happening. Just wait. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. And it never happened. I'm like, no. But,
I think I would have liked it that ending.
That would have been super cute.
Let's do an alternate ending on the DVD. That's what happens.
Yes, okay. There's a gentleman online, or it could be female. I don't know. Because you're anonymity, but thank you, number one, for being live with us online, and you ask a question. Does anyone not think La La Land for Best Picture on Oscars? It's definitely going to get a nomination. And, you know, it's so being early, as they are right now, like, just knowing what I know today on this date, which is, December 16th, just with the information given, I would say yes. I mean, just right now, with the groundswell on this movie being what it is, I would say yes. But there are other movies that are also getting some equal attention there are too many unknown factors.
Right. And I was talking to a few people in the industry about exactly that question. Who's going to get Best Picture at the Oscars? And I think we were saying La La Land seems like a good sure. option for sure. But it could go with the way the Academy votes also to Loving. Like, it would be another way that... It, and those are very different films.
Yeah. It's as of right now, like I said, I would say yes. Only because of the groundswell around this movie. But it'll be interesting to see how various pieces of the puzzle fall into place. I don't look at the Golden Globes as a major barometer for Oscar. But it's going to definitely be interesting. I will say, I do believe that Emma Stone will get Best Actress. I mean, I think that she was like literally phenomenal to pull off what she was able to pull off in this movie.
I think the technical aspects for this film will definitely get nominated to cinematography.
They'll get nominated, absolutely.
Yeah, maybe not writing. But maybe it like could, the sound now, editing.
I think
well.
I would disagree. I think for writing, I think it'll get a Best Original Screenplay.
Okay.
Because it is, you can't take away it's original. Yeah. And it's, for sake of not having been done in a very long time, you know, it's, I think it'll get a nomination for at least original screenplay.
Go ahead.
Yes, Becca. I think for Best Actress, the, like, from what I've heard, the biggest competition that Emma Stone might have is maybe Natalie Portman
for Jackie.
Interesting. I think it'll be interesting just in how the voting goes and the fact that the Academy, who essentially votes on these awards, are all industry people, so all understand LA and understand the struggle for the dream. So I wonder if that's going to have any influence or if it's going to help or hurt. You know, either people are going to say, like, really, it's going to really resonate with them, or it's going to be like, oh, well, I don't know, that wasn't how my experience was, like, you know?
The industry,
it's too close to home.
But the industry loves the industry.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a thing too. The industry loves the industry, so it has that going for it. It's going to be a very interesting, I think, right now going into certain things, a very interesting Academy Award season. I believe it's been a really solid year's a solid year for movies, whether you're only into blockbusters or whether you're into independent movies. You know, Hell or High Water is I think an underappreciated, amazing film that came out earlier this year. And I mentioned this movie Sing Street, which, like, I don't know, like five people saw, and I know one person that saw it three times, so let's say eight people saw it, one person saw it three times. There have been some really exceptional movies this entire year, not just during Academy Award time. You know, we talked about, like, The Jungle Book much earlier on, and that to me was a,
like, March.
That was that was a really solidly done commercial film that didn't have a right to be as good as I think it was. So I just think that it's going to be fascinating as we're really, like, we're off the starting blocks for award season, and La La Land right now is definitely getting the majority of the attention.
The first award show of the season, the Critics' Choice Awards, they won that, so they're off to the races.
Definitely off. We would be remiss if we didn't talk about the music. So from Justin Hurwitz, Becca's clapping, so I think she liked the music. But, I mean, Becca, you downloaded the soundtrack.
Yeah, during the credits, I downloaded the soundtrack.
Wait, did you but there are two soundtracks to this movie. There is the musical aspect soundtrack, and there is the score soundtrack, minus the musical number, like the dance number, so to speak.
I have the soundtrack that has, like, it includes, like, the planetarium stuff, the montage song, the epilogue, and all the musical numbers.
Mm-hmm. So you pretty much had the deluxe version?
I think, maybe, yeah. I was like, this soundtrack is too incredible not to buy, and I love musicals, so.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think J.K. Simmons in one of his interviews made a good point about the music. He said, you walk out of the theater whistling or humming to what is in your head. And that was so true. I mean, like 2 hours after the movie, I was singing the song that Emma Stone sang at the end audition, you know, and like thinking about how much it resonates, like the foolish dreamers, you know, and the hearts that break and all that. So it's absolutely true. And even waking up this morning, I was thinking about the music. So it definitely had a big impact. And just the fact that it, you know, there were so many different styles in there. It went from classical, it went to, you know, big band jazz, it went to kind of old Hollywood, like, you know, so I like that there was a lot going on, but it all felt like it flowed together nicely.
And even John Legend.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot about that. Yeah, absolutely.
And he was a producer on this film. So, like, I knew that he had this credit before I saw the film. Mm. And then I was like, oh, there he is.
Yeah.
Like, even the short amount of time he was on screen, like, he brought a different sound to the movie compared to what they already established in their earlier numbers.
And I know I read an interview with Ryan Gosling talking about that he was concerned about that, like, transition from, like, everyday life into singing songs and how that was going to play out for audiences. And I felt like in this movie, that did not bother me one bit. They did it so well. And, like, I saw clips early on where they're floating up in the planetarium. Exactly. And I was like, that seems like it's going to be weird. And it wasn't weird at all. Like, they just kind of, like, took you on this journey. And I think the music really helped with that.
But that's what any good musical should do. Like, you shouldn't be, like, you know, whether you're watching West Side Story, The Music Man, South Pacific, them breaking into song. If you know you're watching a musical, then you sort of kind of are expecting this, but it should be seamless. You know, again, my other favorite scene, I mentioned that the Griffith Observatory, that was they had to build that in a soundstage because there's no filming allowed inside the Griffith Observatory, and they were definitely not allowed to hang wires or things so that they can float upon. But again, for me, that was just a very truly magical scene for me personally. I just loved how they're floating through time and space and the backgrounds that were chosen and the nebulas,
the color.
It was just beautiful. And having that setting be inside of a planetarium.
It's again, literally amongst the stars.
Like, if you're not establishing that this is a extremely romantic movie, to me that was an extremely romantic, just beautiful scene together, dancing amongst the stars. In the way that it was shot, and I had no idea that they had to go on a soundstage and recreate the Griffith Observatory. Again, I think Chazelle's passion for Los Angeles, like, it's through these wonderful rose-colored glasses. I don't mean this as a slight, but, you know, we're in L.A., you're going, like, the Griffith Observatory, and there's nobody there. Like, it's just empty.
That never happens.
You know?
I'm like, what Griffith
Observatory? I love, and tying it into Rebel Without a Cause, which, you know, in a sense, put the Griffith Observatory, I mean, so much, there's a key scene film there. Mm-hmm. So, again, we are in a year of nostalgia for film, where it's just throwback after throwback after throwback, whether it's a huge blockbuster or whether it's an independent film. You know, people, for whatever reason, they're having this purchase of going back to the classic days of making movies. So,
yeah, and another cool thing about this film, like, most of the tracks were pre-recorded, but there were some performances that were actually live.
Right.
Like, Ryan Gosling would sing live, and Emma Stone, during the big audition at the end, she wanted to sing that live, so it had a more diegetic sound.
And that's just incredible to think about, to be able to pull off that level of performance live like that is incredible.
And to get to that emotional level in that song.
Definitely.
I felt it really amped up the performance.
I think it gives them, like, the push for Oscars, going back to that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, and again, I was more amazed as to how Emma Stone can carry a note, you know. And again, Ryan Gosling was not miserable at singing, but
tolerable.
You know, yeah,
tolerable.
I mean, he was fine. I get it. But Emma Stone, to me, like, okay, I get why she was in Cabaret, like. In her background growing up, too, she loved musicals, but she can sing, she can dance. And
I mean, Ryan Gosling's also been doing it forever. He was on the Mickey Mouse Club.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
Back in the day. Like, I mean, like, this is a guy who, like, yeah, he's been doing this kind of, like, but his charisma, I think, is unbelievable on camera.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And again, the movie that I really, the movie that I personally, like, couldn't take my eyes off him, and this is from a professional and from an acting sense, was Drive. I mean, he had a charisma that I hadn't seen since Steve McQueen. He has those steely eyes, and yet he can be in a comedy. Nice Guys is probably one of my top five movies of this year, and he, along with Russell Crowe, were fantastic, but he's just great, and he can be deadpan, and he did something in Nice Guys that I haven't seen since Abbott and Costello. He did a whole Abbott and Costello shtick, and I'm like, who does that and gets away and still makes it funny? Ryan Gosling did. Oh, he was also in The Big Short, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
He was fantastic in The Big Short. Yeah. You know, he can do it all, and he can be dry comedy, but he still has this coolness of Steve McQueen.
Like The Notebook.
Dreamy, like, heart eyes emoji. Yeah.
I think, again, he's one of the few actors, though, who really stretches between genre. Like, he's done musicals to drama. Yeah. I mean, really dramatic work to musicals to comedy. Like, he really kind of goes between and, like, Yeah.
And he has such a charming feel to him, which I think really this film just, you know, kind of match made in heaven between.
So let's get into a little bit of the numbers and box office. With the budget at $30 million, with P&A, Dimitri, you said it around 60.
Yeah, I mean, it, everything's going to depend on how much Lionsgate Summit is going to be prepared to start pushing. You know, to start pushing, like, with all the award things, they're going to have to push more and more and more. So that means you're going to be changing your television advertising and your print advertising and potentially your in-theater, like, posters to start denouncing. Again, this is for the sake of conversation. They haven't won, like, Golden Globes or anything. But let's just say for in our little world right here, like, they start winning Golden Globes and start, then those are going to be added to the ads. And it'll be, you know, you'll see the television ads that say La La Land, winner of Best Picture or Best Comedy Musical for the Golden Globes, and Emma Stone, winner of Best Actress and this and that. More money. So, you know, when you get that groundswell, you got to spend more money. So it could be 60 to 70 million. I mean, this is all an educated guesstimate that I'm putting on, knowing what Lionsgate would want to put towards marketing. But the movie's going to expand as well. And you don't want to oversaturate, but you're going to have to make more hard drives for that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then you're going to be hoping for the best, that the groundswell, that people are going to want to go see a musical. Here's where they sort of kind of did a really good job. Once it started doing these festivals like Sundance and all that, you couldn't not hear or hear about La La Land if you pay attention to that. It got to a point with me where I was hating the movie before it came out because that's all I was hearing about. Oh, La La Land this, La La Land this. You got to see La La Land. And I'm the type of person who sort of kind of like, no, I don't. I don't have to see it. And, like, because it's what everybody was talking about. And I had read an article where Lionsgate, like, is too much buzz bad for business? And they actually, I don't know if they saw that article or felt the same way, but they really pulled back in their advertising. They stopped, which was, I think, a smart move, because once they started to release the movie, they started to let the reviews come out and people start talking about the movie. And I think they've done a really good job. They've also done a good job in sort of masking that it's a musical.
Yeah.
Because, like, if you watch the trailer, you're not seeing full music numbers. It was almost like that, what's it called, Into the Woods?
Oh.
Okay. Right. Into the Woods, the marketing sort of kind of hid the fact that it's a musical. They're doing, you know, they're making La La Land look dreamy. Like, they show them, you know, in the Griffith's Observatory, which is imagery. So you're selling good imagery, but you're hiding the fact that it's a musical, which is sort of kind of smart in this day and age. With the artist, you can't hide the fact that it's black and white. Like, you can hide the fact that it's silent, maybe, but not that it's black and white.
No, yeah. But I think that La La Land, just kind of going off of that, might be the perfect title for this movie. Like, aptly named, like, yeah. And, like, I think just the title alone, you should know what you're walking into. Like, yeah.
Well, I don't think that it says that it's a musical.
No,
like, you know the kind of story you're going to be walking into.
Yeah. I don't think it would get as much buzz personally if the title wasn't La La Land.
Could be. Yeah.
I don't. Dreamers.
Yeah.
In LA.
Yeah. Especially exactly. Double meaning there.
Because, like, everyone who, like, he was tweeting about it, like, 2 weeks ago before I saw it and, like, had me wanting to see it was, I feel like they were part of the reason they kind of loved it is because they live here and they're like, oh, La La Land.
Mm-hmm. My question is, do you think this film would be successful once they release it worldwide?
Well, they already have foreign markets, and actually that's one of the reasons why Chazelle decided to go with Lionsgate Summit is because they do already have in place a great foreign team to sell off into foreign territories, which they've done. It's opened up in foreign territories and has done $4 million already. You know, its worldwide gross thus far is $6 million, with foreign being 79.5% of that gross. Domestically, right now, it's only done like 1.2 million as of say yesterday's, including.
But it's only in 2 cities at this point.
It's in 200 locations currently.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, when it opened up, it was New York, and it got the highest per screen average. It had beaten out the, if memory serves, it was Grand Budapest Hotel, which opened up very similar. It had the highest per location average. When La La Land came out, it beat Grand Budapest for that. So it's going to be interesting to see how we do 200 theaters. They'll obviously expand. The Golden Globes are, within the first week of January or so. So we'll see what happens then. We'll see how wide they go. Like I said, the only movie I can sort of compare this to is The Artist. And that ended up topping off of $44 million, which I was surprised at.
I mean, it was surprising. We went on a Monday night in Hollywood to this movie, and it was a pretty full theater, a Monday night. Like, it was...
Yeah, and the demographic was all 20-some people. In their mid-20s, 30s. You know, it was our demographic.
Yeah. I think with the, like, limited release that they do, I saw Manchester by the Sea last week, and it was kind of the same thing. Like, I had to really search to find a theater close to me that was playing it. And same with this one. I think I looked on a Monday to watch it, and the next movie time was not till, like, a Thursday or something crazy around me. So I think everybody likes kind of the exclusivity of things, you know, where you're like, oh my God, this isn't really out. I want to go see it. What is it? You know, so I think that kind of amps it up a little bit, kind of playing into audiences going to see this. But I think once it gets released wide, I think people are still going to see it just because of the cast and because of the now what people are saying about it and because it's something that's different. You know, there's nothing really like this. So I think it kind of piques people's interest a little bit.
They also did a good job here, I think, especially, like, getting the cast and crew to participate in, like, Q&As over the past weekend at, like, the theaters that were playing it, which I think helped with marketing a bit.
Agreed. And what makes that special for the studio is when your cast and crew is willing to do that.
Because
it takes time, okay? A lot of cast and or crew... Like, they don't want to... Well, no, they're above it. Some people are just hard to get. I think it's a united front where they all really respect the work that they've done in this movie. Yeah. And they also know that they're going into award season. So it's part of the quote-unquote campaign. You know, it's very interesting. And it'll be interesting to see how that gets fine-tuned. And, you know, who do we start to see a little bit more of? You know, will it be, like... Because eventually, you know, it's like a Sophie's Choice. The studio is going to have to... Well, they're going to have to, like, pick the person that they think is going to have the best chance. They're not going to want to slight the other person. But, like, you know, so you may start to see Emma Stone a little bit more than Ryan Gosling.
I think, at least so far, the studio's been really, really smart. In a lot of interviews, they've been paired together. Like, I think for Junkets, they've been mostly together, which shows their chemistry. It reminds you of their pairing because people, again, they're that known commodity. And I think that they're going to be the driving force behind people seeing this outside of L.A.
Yeah. They're like the modern-day Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan.
Yeah, sort of, that's true.
Yeah, and I'm just saying, like, once you start to hone your Academy Award campaign, you sort of kind of get a sense as to, you know, where the attention's being focused to, and that's where you start putting your money in, because you want to, you know, a lot of it does come down. It's politicking at the end of the day. A person like Mark Rylance, who ends up winning for Best Actor last year, who literally came out of nowhere because he didn't do any of that stuff, but still ended up winning for the Steven Spielberg
Bridge of Spies.
And people were like,
so good.
What?
It was
like, what happened?
Really great.
So it's just...
That's why I also say it's too early.
It's very It's very early. It is. We don't have a lot of pieces of the puzzle. I think it's... I do want to mention this, since we were talking about box office, and I did mention The Artist. At its widest, The Artist went to over 1,700 locations. So it'll be interesting to see how wide Lionsgate can take... La La Land.
Interesting. Cassandra says, thank you, Cassandra, in the live chat. I do not think that because this is a movie set in the modern day with actors who have been recognizable names, this film has more potential for their domestic box office than The Artist.
Me too.
You know what? I agree with that.
Yeah, I think that's a fair argument for sure.
Because I think the great thing about The Artist is you can watch this in other countries and still understand the stories and the characters.
Yeah.
And there's no dialogue driving like a story. It's really character driven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. And to your point, you know, The Artist domestically did $44 million, where in foreign it did 88. So The Artist had a worldwide gross of $133 million, which is sort of surprising for me, considering it was a $15 million budgeted movie. So we're sort of kind of seeing it, you know, again, I gotta preface, I'm talking just about today. Just about what information I have as of December 16th. We already see that the gross is foreign for La La Land are higher than what they are domestically. So it'll be, like I said, it'll be fun to find out, as the old ads for the Boston Museum of Science used to say. It'll be fun to find out.
Yeah, I mean, and it's getting high ratings. IMDb is 8.8. Rotten Tomatoes is 94. And Tatometer and 90% audience. Do you agree with this? That's high.
Yeah, I was trying to think of another film I had seen that was at 94%. That's so high.
What, on Rotten Tomatoes? Oh, no, there's Manchester by the Sea is like 97.
Manchester by the Sea was high. And Moana was also high on Rotten Tomatoes. Those three films, La La Land, Manchester by the Sea, and Moana, I think were kind of the highest ratings. When you see that on Rotten Tomatoes, you're like, okay, this film has to be good. I mean, the fact that it's in the high 90s, that's crazy. But I totally agree. I think just also the audience rate of 90% also is also very high, which it seems like obviously most people, you know, enjoyed this film, and I was one of them.
Okay. All right. Any last thoughts before we wrap this up? Overall, very fun movie.
I loved it. I'm definitely going to go see it again. I already have a couple people that have said, like, when you're ready to go again, I'm going to go with you. I'm like, sign me up. Let's go, you know? So I'm excited. I'm excited to see this again. And I think it's one of those films where it kind of caught me by surprise as I was in the theater watching it. And I'm excited to go back now that I know kind of how everything unfolds and kind of watch it again, maybe from a different perspective or a different point of view after kind of seeing how it ends. But I am definitely also going to get the music. I thought it was great, and I think it's a film that was very interesting, very unique, that I really enjoyed. So
I felt like this was a movie that you know, I'd heard so much hype around, and it really did live up to it. It's so fun and just an enjoyable movie. I love the music of it, and Yeah, I think I already like talked my parents into going to it. So like I'm going to be going and seeing this. And I think it is one of those timeless movies where like, yeah, there are modern day moments in it. But like in 10 years, I can still imagine watching this movie and enjoying it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Totally. I agree completely with the timeless part that you mentioned. One of my favorite scenes that I have to mention real quick is the someone in the crowd scene at the hotel at the pool. Because I liked the cameras.
Waving around. Yeah,
I think scene. That was just such a fun number. I was completely like into it the whole time. My eyes never left the screen.
Right.
And no distractions. Nothing can distract me from this film. So yeah. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, you know, by virtue of it being original, like it is a funny town that they say, oh, we need more original content. We want more original movies. And sometimes when that movie is delivered, people just don't go. It's refreshing to see a movie like La La Land because it is different than what we've seen, you know, in recent times. It's not a superhero movie. It's not, people do fly in the movie, folks, but it's not a superhero movie. So, you know, there are magic moments. Like I said, the romantic in me wanted a different ending. I think it didn't stick the ending quite for me. Mm-hmm. We'll be watching it, obviously, for its box office, its award nominations. For me, am I going to see it again? No, not really. I mean, I think I got so many other movies to see, and it's not that I dislike this movie. I wanted to like it more. I'll say that. I wanted to walk away from this movie feeling, I wanted it to be the perfect antithesis to Manchester by the Sea. Given the choice, I'd rather see Manchester by the Sea again for its amazing performances and direction. And again, another original story, not to take away. This is pure magic. On see it on a big screen, yes. Folks. And I urge you, Academy members, screw your screeners. Go to the movie to see this. Because make that informed opinion and judgment on this movie. Like, don't see it. I don't care how big your television screen is. You are missing out if you see it any other way.
Yeah.
I got it. Like, whether I love this movie or didn't, it looked beautiful on a big screen.
Anthony.
So that's my final thought.
I'm excited for this movie to be at, like, an outdoor movie.
Yes.
So fun.
Somewhere in LA.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Street food cinema.
Yeah.
Here's
an idea.
Hello.
Yes. I really enjoyed this film. The musical fan in me loved it. The romantic, the hopeless romantic in me, I thought it felt a little flat. But overall, this movie, visually, it was beautiful. And technicality-wise, it was over the top. And the rewatchability factor is definitely there. So thank you, everyone, for tuning in for our La La Land dissection. In the meantime, where can everyone keep following you?
You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Becca B Talks TV.
Egan, please support me on Twitter at dmovies1701.
And you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at OMG, it's MLE.
And you can find me at Stephanie Winger.
And you can follow me on Twitter at Serafini TV. You can follow all of us here at Movie Anatomy on Twitter, at The Popcorn Talk on Twitter, social media, all those fun social media places. And we definitely have other Oscar dissections in the bag and upcoming.
Yeah,
so
upcoming.
Stay tuned. We're definitely going to cover as many as we possibly can.
And I want to say a hearty thank you to the people who are online.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's awesome.
You joined in on the discussion of a movie that's very worthy and deserving of the discussion, and you were great. So this is what we want to encourage people to do. So thank you very much, folks, for being online with us. I think it makes this discussion all the more special.
It does.
Yeah. Thank you, movie fans, and we will see you next time.
Bye. Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.